At this point, a very different sort of individual entered the field, someone who would have his own ideas about how these electric discoveries could be used. Samuel Morse had studied fine arts at Phillips and Yale, and in his early 20s, he was living off his parents' money in London. He seemed to be just another ethereal art student explaining, in one of his many letters home, that he was asking for more money not because of his difficulties in painting a portrait that actually looked much like any of his sitters, but rather because, and one has to be honest here, he was too good for even the refined British to recognize. "Had I no higher thoughts than being a first-rate portrait painter," he explained to his mother, "I would have chosen a far different profession. My ambition is to be among those who shall revive the splendor of the 15th century, to rival the genius of a Raphael, a Michelangelo, or a Titian." But underneath that genteel pose, Morse was raving. His father, an evangelical Calvinist, had brought him up to believe that America was being destroyed by secret conspiracies. And when Morse returned to America and found he still couldn't make a living, he took his father's ideas and went further. The awful powers that were attacking America and keeping deserving artists from commercial success were ones he alone had now identified. There were Negroes and Jews and other undesirables, of course, but behind them all were the Catholics, and behind them were the Jesuits, secret armed Jesuits, fanning out from their missions across the United States, storing guns in Irish nunneries, and all under the control of the Emperor of Austria. When his pamphlets were ignored, he took it as a further sign of the conspiracy. So in 1836, Morse ran for mayor of New York with straightforward slogans to persecute Catholics. "We have to resist the momentous evil that threatens us," he wrote. "Will you not awake to the reality of your danger? Up, up, I beseech you, to your posts." He lost, of course, and then he started sulking, and then, holed up in an isolated area in one of the highest buildings overlooking the recently founded New York University, he worked out what needed to be done. The Jesuits were controlling America through invisible forces, so it was necessary that Morse, and all other good Americans, develop a similar means of fighting back. Something that could stretch everywhere and flash information along at the speed of electricity would be just about ideal. Luckily, on a ship voyage from London not long before, he had overheard one passenger discuss some of the ways electricity was being used for such long-distance contacts. It was pretty well known. Joseph Henry was teaching at the College of New Jersey, soon to be renamed Princeton University, and some news of his work had been publicized. There also had been similar trials in Europe. Charles Wheatstone and William Cook in England, for example, had stretched a wire from the train terminal at Euston in London to a train depot at a strange round building in Camden, over a mile away. When they connected the Euston end of the wire to a battery, an electromagnet in Camden got switched on. The local residents loved it, for the single telegraph wire replaced the piercing whistle and whoppingly loud drums that had been used to communicate arrivals and departures before. Now, in his New York retreat, after struggling to make a telegraph of his own work efficiently, he suffered from as great a lack of ability in his mechanical tinkering as in his artistic efforts. Morse almost gave up in frustration. He was certain that there had to be an easier way, so he decided to get help from someone who actually knew how these mysterious electrical substances operated and could explain it to him. Which is how, probably on a spring day in 1838, Joseph Henry found a surprisingly impassioned ex-painter at the door of his Princeton office. Henry was as easygoing at Princeton as he had been in Albany. The students liked him. By now he was stretching telegraph cables for more than a mile around the Princeton campus, and students regularly helped him in the work. Henry had often declared that patents were the sort of thing that had held Europe back. He happily explained to Morse how his system worked, the batteries and the electromagnet and the spools of wire. In America, a young and growing country, it was right and proper, Henry believed, for all good citizens to share what they learned. When Morse left Princeton, he knew what was best for one good citizen at least. He'd always been keen to patent anything he could. While still an artist, he'd struggled with an impractical marble carving device, and he'd patented the information he'd picked up from Henry's work, as well as techniques he'd learned from reading European reports. The idea of using a simple code for the telegraph was already surprisingly widespread. The great German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss, who'd strung a telegraph along his Göttingen campus in 1833, had set up his receiving electromagnet to tug a needle either to the left or the right. If it shifted to the right, that meant a letter such as an E was intended. If it shifted to the left, that could mean the letter A. Two shifts to the right might signify an I, while other combinations of left and right signified other letters, all the way to the least common letters, such as X and Z. Other researchers regularly came up with similar codes, for it made sense to have the simplest signals stand for the most common letters and more complex signals stand for rare letters. It was possible to find which letters were most common simply by going to a print shop and looking. Typesetters tended to accumulate big boxes of type bearing the letter E, since they had to use them so often. They had only smaller boxes for the rarely demanded Q, X, and Z.